Chapter 5. Payday. On January 5, 1854, Ulysses S. Grant, after sailing 250 miles up the coast from San Francisco on a long and tedious voyage, arrived at Fort Humboldt, a scenic but abysmally secluded destination. The fort commanded a 100-foot bluff with spacious views of Humboldt Bay and the sea beyond, and was hemmed in by deep stands of towering sequoia and redwood trees steeped in perpetual shadow. Since one could only reach San Francisco by water, mail trickled in on an irregular basis. The largest nearby town was Eureka, a modest hamlet with a handful of sawmills and approximately 500 people. The officers' quarters and furnishings were rough-hewn from giant logs cut from nearby forests. Aside from recreational drinking and dancing, the only available pastimes were fishing and hunting elk, deer, and black bears, activities that awakened little interest in Grant. The claustrophobic setting exacerbated his solitude, making him feel fearfully cut off from the outer world and tipping him over the edge psychologically. Imagine a place closed in by the sea, having thrown up two tongues of land, closed in a bay that can be entered only with certain winds, he told Julia. Only a month after his arrival, he lapsed into self-pity. You do not know how forsaken I feel here. A pall smothered his often sparkling prose, which lost its humor, buoyancy, and charm. I got one letter from you since I have been here, but it was some 3 months old, he complained, speculating that little Ulysses Jr. must be talking by now. His laments betray the earmarks of acute depression, including lethargy and indifference to his environment. I do nothing here but sit in my room and read and occasionally take a short ride on one of the public horses. He had applied for orders to travel to Washington to settle his Mexican War account and remained despondent over unaccountable delays. The state of suspense that I am in is scarcely bearable, he declared. Grant watched despair etch deep lines in his face. When he had a troublesome tooth extracted, his face swelled up until it was as round as an apple. And as he stared at himself in the mirror, he reflected gloomily, I think I could pass readily for a person of 45. He came down with chills and fever that February and had to be treated for severe attacks. His colleagues readily intuited his profound yearning for his family and the turmoil engendered by their absence. One day, when he lost a ring that Julia had given him at their engagement, he was beside himself. The intrepid soldier who preserved his coolness in the bloodiest battles was completely unstrung, recalled a local businessman. The next morning, half of the command was turned out and the parade ground was panned until the ring was found. With relatively little work to do, Grant found himself at loose ends. He roved around the post wearing a battered straw hat and puffing on a pipe or cigar. Taking excellent care of his company, he planted a garden to furnish them with fresh vegetables and arranged with a local hunter to serve fresh elk meat, but such work yielded little comfort. He was an ordinary-looking man with firmly set mouth and deep, searching eyes that seemed to take me in at a glance and then turned indifferently away, said a local rancher. Because local Indians posed no real threat, all the drills and discipline performed at the post seemed pointless and irksome. Hypersensitive to taunts, Grant had been singled out as a target by bullies since boyhood. As he already knew, the commanding officer at Fort Humboldt, Robert C. Buchanan, was a martinet who had graduated from West Point in 1830, serving with distinction in the Mexican War. For his admirers, Buchanan was a consummate professional with elegant manners. One associate remembered, a man of refined habits, a courtly gentleman, fine physique and of commanding presence, respected and admired, a thorough officer in all duties or obligations to his government or military standard of excellence. But a darker side often governed Robert Buchanan, who enjoyed meting out punishment to those who did not share his punctilious regard for military etiquette. As A.P. Marble, Grant's body servant, put it, "Colonel Buchanan was an efficient officer, but strict in petty details to the verge of absurdity." George Crook, who served under the ornery Buchanan before Grant arrived, left a chilling portrait of his despotism. "Our commander seemed particularly elated at his own importance. He seemed to take delight in wounding the feelings of those under him, and succeeded pretty generally in making himself unpopular amongst the citizens as well as the army." Grant and Buchanan were bound to clash. Grant could be slovenly in dress and careless in his habits, and was sure to grate on a spick-and-span officer. He was nettled by this blustering new boss, who insisted upon tight procedures at a remote outpost where such cavilling seemed misplaced. Buchanan had already been alerted by Benjamin Alvord to Grant's drinking problem and pledge of abstinence, a handy weapon to brandish over his new captain. Unfortunately for Grant, alcohol was ubiquitous at Fort Humboldt. Once morning drills ended, officers resorted to whiskey and poker to pass the time. Commissary whiskey of the vilest kind was to be had in unlimited quantities, and all partook, more or less, said a military wife. To deal with his private sadness and mitigate the pain of migraine headaches, Grant got into the habit of drinking more frequently, often stopping for alcoholic refreshment at a local saloon or a general store run by James T. Ryan. Buchanan's adjutant, Lewis Cass Hunt, said Grant used to go on long sprees till his whole nature would rebel, and then he would be sick. Echoing comments made elsewhere, a beef contractor named W.I. Reed claimed Grant drank less often than other officers, but with more harmful consequences, for, with his peculiar organization, a little did the fatal work of a great deal. He had very poor brains for drinking. In his memoirs, Grant was adamant that he left the army voluntarily that spring from a wish to be reunited with his family. "I saw no chance of supporting them on the Pacific coast out of my pay as an army officer. I concluded, therefore, to resign." This became the standard version favored by Julia, the Grant family, and several biographers, and little doubt exists that Grant meditated seriously retirement from the army. "I sometimes get so anxious to see you and our little boys that I am almost tempted to resign and trust to Providence and my own exertions for a living where I can have you and them with me," he told Julia in early March 1854. Then in the next breath, he backtracked from this impractical wish. "Whenever I get to thinking upon the subject, however, poverty begins to stare me in the face. And then I think, what would I do if you and our little ones should want for the necessaries of life?" Grant said he was so depressed he hadn't strayed more than 100 yards from his quarters for 2 weeks. "But you never complain of being lonesome, so I infer that you are quite contented." Then he related a dream that seemed laced with fear, jealousy, and barely disguised anger. "I thought you were at a party when I arrived, and before paying any attention to my arrival, you said you must go. You were engaged for that dance." It was not the first time Grant betrayed jealousy or accused Julia of being indifferent to his desperate plight. While Grant laid down the preferred version of his resignation in his memoirs, where he never breathed a syllable about his drinking problem to posterity, he was more candid in later private conversations, telling Civil War chaplain John Eaton that the vice of intemperance had not a little to do with my decision to resign. To General Augustus Chetlin, he admitted that, "When I have nothing to do, I get blue and depressed. I have a natural craving for a drink. When I was on the coast, I got in a depressed condition and got to drinking." Overwhelming evidence suggests that Grant resigned from an alcohol problem. Lewis Cass Hunt told several people how Buchanan sent him to reprimand Grant after one drinking episode. As Colonel Granville O. Holler heard the tale, Hunt told Grant that Colonel Buchanan would withdraw the drinking charge if Grant didn't offend again. He had Grant write out his resignation, omitting the date. There was an explicit understanding that if Grant forgot his pledge, Buchanan would forward his resignation and save Grant the odium of being cashiered by a general court-martial. The journalist Benjamin Perley Poor later confirmed that Buchanan had warned Grant, "You had better resign or reform," to which Grant responded, "I will resign if I don't reform." One Sunday morning, Grant showed up at his company's pay table under the influence of drink. Bristling at this display, Buchanan told Hunt to buckle on his sword and lay down the law to Grant, warning that if he did not resign, he would face a court-martial. According to Colonel Thomas M. Anderson, who heard the story from Hunt, Grant put his face down in his hand for a long time and then commenced writing something. Grant said that he did not want his wife to know that he had ever been tried. Grant then signed his resignation and he gave it to the commanding officer. Some of Grant's friends, convinced he would have been acquitted, pleaded with him to stand trial. Henry C. Hodges said the regiment deemed Buchanan's action unnecessarily harsh and severe. Rufus Ingalls, Grant's old roommate at West Point and Fort Vancouver, believed that since Grant had not been incapacitated by drink, he would have been exonerated, but he confirmed that Grant refused to stand trial because he would not for all the world have his wife know that he had been tried on such a charge. The idea that Grant feared Julia's wrath makes one wonder whether she had extracted a strict promise from him to refrain from drinking altogether. During the Civil War, Thomas M. Anderson discussed Grant's resignation with Robert Buchanan, then his commander in the Army of the Potomac. "I was very intimate with Colonel Buchanan and had my first information as to the Humboldt episode from him. I remember absolutely that Colonel Buchanan told me distinctly that he had condoned a similar offense in Grant before he fired, or as he said, permitted his resignation as a favor." From discussions with Lewis Cass Hunt, Anderson, later commander at Fort Vancouver, added that Hunt had warned Grant not to show up intoxicated at the pay table and had even volunteered to go in his place, but Grant had refused. On April 11, 1854, Grant received his formal commission as full captain. Having achieved this rank, he tendered his resignation to Colonel Buchanan while confirming his commission in a simultaneous letter to the War Department. His resignation may have stemmed from a convergence of factors. Grant knew Buchanan was conducting a vendetta against him and did not want to endure a humiliating trial. He may also have reflected that he was profoundly unhappy with Army life, could not afford to bring his family out west, and was dying a slow death in the service. Hence, Grant may have seen a redeeming side to his resignation, even though it had been wrung from him against his will. The story of Grant's resignation echoed down the years into the Civil War. In the small peacetime army, libels and scandals traveled swiftly among officers, whose rotations at far-flung outposts guaranteed wide currency for gossip. In such a situation, soldiers had to guard their reputations, or missteps could dog them for years. Starting in April 1854, Grant's bibulous nature became a part of Army folklore, and, rightly or wrongly, he was never again entirely free from charges of being a drunkard. The reason for Grant's resignation in 1854 was known. General Michael R. Morgan subsequently commented, "Grant's case was unusual at the time and was discussed by the Army." During the Civil War, both sides knew what had unfolded at Fort Humboldt. As the Union General James H. Wilson wrote, "It is a part of the history of the times that Grant had fallen for a season into the evil ways of military men serving on the remote frontier, and that his return to civil life was commonly believed to have been a choice between resignation and a court-martial. The grapevine even reached deep into the Confederacy, where diarist Mary Chestnut would allude to Grant's earlier downfall in the Far West. "Put out of the army for habitual drunkenness." Grant did not notify his censorious father of his resignation, an omission suggesting deep fear or shame. A perturbed Jesse Grant learned about it after Jefferson Davis accepted the resignation on June 2nd, and then he tried to prevail upon his local congressman, Andrew Ellison, to get the decision reversed. When that failed, he sent a humane letter to Jefferson Davis entreating him to withdraw his acceptance of the resignation. He thought Ulysses had been conditioned by the army and could never readjust to civilian life. He penned prophetic words. "I think after spending so much time to qualify himself for the army and spending so many years in the service, he will be poorly qualified for the pursuits of private life." He requested a 6-month leave for his son, who has not seen his family for over 2 years and has a son nearly 2 years old he has never seen. I suppose in his great anxiety to see his family, he has been induced to quit the service. Unfortunately, Davis considered the matter settled, and his reply delicately evaded the true reason behind the resignation. He observed that since Ulysses had assigned no reasons why he desired to quit the service, and the motives which influenced him are not known to the department, he would let the decision stand. Grant's failure to specify a reason for departing from the army strengthens the suspicion that drinking lay at its root. Fiercely protective of her husband's reputation, Julia's indignation was intense as stories spread in army circles and were whispered in St. Louis about Ulysses' resignation, wrote Julia's biographer, Ishbel Ross. Her sister Emma was no less irate at the notion that alcohol had undone Grant's army career. "It is not true that the captain's personal habits at that time led him into such difficulties that he was asked to resign." Julia spent a lifetime reflexively denying such problems and glossing over the purgatorial months at Fort Humboldt. "He was happy in the fight and the din of battle, but restless in the barracks," she later explained to a reporter. "He resigned from the army and took a plantation in Missouri and went to farming." Grant was no less breezily dismissive to the press. "When I resigned from the army and went to a farm, I was happy." Grant stood on firmer ground in later arguing that his army departure was providential. "If I had stayed in the army, I would have been still a captain on frontier duty at the outbreak of the war, and would thus have been deprived of the right to offer my services voluntarily to the country." Indeed, his momentary disgrace can be seen in retrospect as his salvation, preserving him for a starring role in the Civil War instead of stranding him at a post in the hinterland. The nearly 2 years of hardships on the West Coast had engraved a worried expression on Grant's face, giving sad depth to his eyes. He tried to sound sanguine as he prepared to leave Fort Humboldt. "Whoever hears of me in 10 years will hear of a well-to-do old Missouri farmer," he told his comrades. He was still beset by ailments, including migraine headaches and fever, and Colonel Buchanan reported to the Pacific Department headquarters on May 1st, "Captain Grant is too unwell to travel just yet, but we'll proceed to San Francisco by the first steamer." Having turned 32, Grant retained enough self-confidence to know that his life to date did not reflect the wealth of talent stored up inside him. Dr. Jonathan Clark had treated his ailments at Fort Humboldt. In bidding him farewell, Grant spoke these parting words. "Well, doctor, I am out, but I will tell you something, and you mark my words. My day will come. They will hear from me yet." Despite his grim stint at Fort Humboldt, Grant had fallen in love with the natural beauty of Northern California and grown so attached to the place that he had visions of making it his permanent home in future years. On May 7, 1854, Grant boarded the steamer Arispa, heaped with timber and gold dust, bound for San Francisco. A few days earlier, he had written Julia an evasive letter that was short, cryptic, and devoid of his usual effusive affection. He chided her again for not writing, made no mention of his resignation, and simply announced that he had taken a leave of absence. "After receiving this, you may discontinue writing, because before I could get a reply, I shall be on my way home. You might write directing to the city of New York." It was a weirdly elliptical message that testifies to Grant's confusion as to how he should break the shocking news to Julia. The San Francisco that Grant encountered was no longer the rip-roaring, wide-open town he first saw. "Gambling houses had disappeared from public view," he wrote. "The city had become staid and orderly." Short of funds, he went to his friend Captain Thomas H. Stevens, Jr., an officer who had begun a banking business. Grant had left $1,750 with Stevens in January and expected to collect that amount. Stevens offered 2% monthly interest, and a more sophisticated investor might have realized no legitimate banker paid such exorbitant rates. "I can't pay you now," Stevens insisted, "but if you will wait a couple of weeks, I will pay you in time for you to take the next steamer." The obliging Grant agreed. Julia narrated the sequel. At the end of the 2 weeks, the captain returned to find that Stevens had conveniently gone out of town, and the captain was again cheated. Once more, the credulous Grant had been duped by a trickster in what had become a striking pattern. Clearly, other people thought him something of a simpleton who could be defrauded with impunity. Not until 1863, amid the Civil War, did Julia send Stevens a blunt letter and finally receive belated payment. While waiting for Stevens to pay, Grant visited Julia's brother Louis on the Stanislaus River, only to return and find Stevens had vanished. With his life spiraling out of control, Grant grew desperate in his hunt for money. As he walked the streets, consumed with anxiety, he bumped into J.D. Elderkin, who was stunned by Grant's seedy appearance. "I was almost ashamed to speak to him on the street, he looked so bad. I felt very sorry for him, poor fellow." Thanks to the Elijah Camp fiasco, the perfidious T.H. Stevens, and the abortive farming ventures, Grant had squandered money he could ill afford to lose. The chief quartermaster on the West Coast, Robert Allen, an old friend of Grant's, learned he was holed up in a cheap miner's hotel called What Cheer House. He found Grant in a Spartan garret room, furnished with a cot, a pine table, and a chair. "Why, Grant, what are you doing here?" Allen asked. "Nothing," Grant replied. "I have resigned from the army. I'm out of money, and I have no means of getting home." Allen promised to help Grant and encouraged him to stop by his office. Grant could only book passage to New York if he presented a certificate at the quartermaster's office that entitled him to a $40 per diem payment the government owed him. Office clerk Richard L. Ogden remembered Grant shuffling into his workspace late one afternoon, bearing the certificate. When Ogden announced it was improperly drawn up and he had no cash on hand, Grant's countenance fell, and a look of utter despair came over it. Grant asked if he could sleep on a threadbare old lounge chair there, explaining, "I have not a cent to my name." The good-hearted Ogden offered him $1 for lodgings. "I am greatly obliged," Grant said, "but with your permission I will use the dollar for my dinner and breakfast, and the lounge will save me the dollar." The next morning, Ogden not only cashed Grant's certificate, but escorted him to the office of the Pacific Mail Steamship. Since the quartermaster gave ample business to the steamship line, Ogden cajoled the manager into awarding Grant something tantamount to a free pass to New York. This was a godsend for Grant, who received a stateroom far more luxurious than anything he had imagined, and would still have $15 when he arrived in New York. On June 1, 1854, Grant boarded a passenger ship owned by Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, the Sierra Nevada, that would carry him down to Nicaragua. In Washington, Congress had just passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which repealed the Missouri Compromise of 1820 and opened the possibility that settlers could create new slave states in the vast territories of Kansas and Nebraska, igniting explosive controversy. Southern Whigs joined with Democrats to enact the bill, leading Horace Greeley to predict that the passage of this Nebraska bill will arouse and consolidate the most gigantic, determined, and overwhelming party for freedom that the world ever saw. That new party would be the Republican Party. These seminal events would profoundly affect the fortunes of Ulysses S. Grant, who likely knew little of what was happening. When his boat reached the west coast of Nicaragua on June 13th, Grant wrote to Thomas H. Stevens that the place was as hot as the final resting place of the wicked. He referred to Stevens's scandalous behavior in exceedingly mild terms. "I was sorry not to see you before starting. I was anxious to see if some money could not be raised." He said he was owed $500 from Humboldt Bay, which would be sent directly to Stevens. "I wish you would send me a New York check for $500 as soon as you can." There is no evidence the money was ever paid. Within a few days, Grant had crossed Lake Nicaragua and embarked on the steamer Prometheus, which carried him with more than 500 other passengers to New York, where they landed on June 25th. Fresh miseries awaited Grant on the eastern seaboard. At Governor's Island, he was received in kindly fashion by old army friends who loaned him money. He then set out for Sackett's Harbor to collect the $800 Elijah Camp still owed him, riding much of the way on horseback. However dubious he may have been about succeeding, he had already told Julia his fear that the faithless former sutler was slightly deranged. It was his only chance to land some money before facing the inquiring stares of the Grants and the Dents, and he sent a letter ahead to notify Camp he was coming. One version of events claims Elijah Camp went off sailing on Lake Ontario when Grant arrived, having been alerted by Grant's letter. What we know for certain is that Grant failed to extract a single penny. When he had last resided at Sackett's Harbor, a man named Walter Camp, no relation to Elijah, had counseled him about his drinking problem, applauding his courage in joining the Sons of Temperance. Now, with Grant back in town, Camp passed him on horseback and was shocked to see him drunk. "Evidently under the influence of his enemy," was how Camp phrased it. "His temperance principles were well known to me while stationed here, and I was pained to see him overcome by what he had told me years before, that he had such a desire for stimulants that his only safety was in letting them entirely alone." From the way Camp told the story, it is apparent he did not stop to greet Grant, but only sorrowfully observed his fallen state. At this point, the lessons of the Sons of Temperance must have seemed a distant, slightly unreal memory to Grant, who returned to New York City bruised by Elijah Camp's betrayal. Luckily for Grant, he sought out his old West Point chum Simon Bolivar Buckner, who was on commissary duty in New York. Having checked into the Astor House, Grant needed help to pay the hotel tab. According to Buckner, Grant apprised him that his money was all gone and he had been unable to get anything to do and had no means to reach home. He asked for a loan in order to repay his bills at the hotel and reach his father. Buckner introduced Grant to the hotel proprietor and declared he would vouch for his expenses. It is perhaps not surprising that Grant then appealed to his father for money instead of Colonel Dent, who would have gloated over his misery, but it must have irked him to have to be bailed out by his family. From his home in Covington, Kentucky, Jesse responded by dispatching his middle son, Simpson, to New York to fetch Ulysses and settle the hotel bill. It seems rather odd that Jesse chose to send an escort instead of simply arranging credit for Ulysses. One possible solution to this mystery lies in a letter written by Frederick Law Olmsted, the renowned designer of Central Park and other urban parks, to his wife at the end of the Civil War. Olmsted had just spent an evening with Major Ralph W. Kirkham, who recalled that during the summer of 1854, he and Winfield Scott Hancock were stationed at Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, when a letter was received from Buckner telling them that he had found Grant in New York. Grant had resigned, arrived at New York, got drunk, got into a row, and been locked up by the police. Buckner relieved him and supplied him with means to go to his father in Missouri. The story, if true, may suggest why Grant, who was so desperately homesick and eager to see his wife and children, dallied in Manhattan until late summer, and why his brother came to retrieve him. A careful search of the sketchy New York court records for the period fails to provide any confirmation of the story. When Ulysses and Simpson arrived in Covington, Jesse and Hannah Grant must have sensed that their eldest son had slipped off the rails. They were surely disturbed by his altered appearance and the suspicion or knowledge that he had succumbed to his drinking demons. Hannah professed pleasure that her son had left the army. She told a cousin she was sorry Ulysses ever had anything to do with this army business, while Jesse asserted that his son had made a costly mistake and wasn't shy about saying so. He liked to spout a new insight. West Point spoiled one of my boys for business. By now, Ulysses could only envision his life in limited terms, the wings of his ambition having been thoroughly clipped by experience. He stayed with his parents for a week, likely to look presentable when his wife and children set eyes on him. For Julia Grant and her eldest son, Fred, the moment of Ulysses' return to Whitehaven was dreamlike and long enshrined in family lore. 4-year-old Fred, who had his father's broad, open face, was playing on the porch when a bearded man in a buggy drove up the drive. Just as he was throwing the lap robe over the dashboard, a colored woman ran out of the house and said, "It's Mr. Grant." "And so it was," recalled Fred, "but I didn't know him. It is very likely he didn't know me." With both arms, Grant scooped up Fred and Buck, the curly little blonde brother with blue eyes whom he had never seen before. For Julia, it was a moment of inexpressible happiness. "I waited for a long time, never knowing when he would come back," she later wrote. "It was like a dream when he drove up the turnstile." Grant turned to Julia and said, "You know, I had to wait in New York until I heard from you." The biographer William McFeely has suggested that the marriage between Ulysses and Julia Grant may have been on the verge of a severe rupture when he left the army, and it is not impossible that he had nervously awaited some reassurance from her before he returned. Where Grant would live and how he would support himself became urgent matters, and he whisked his family off to Covington to settle them. For Ulysses and Julia Grant, the sting of that terrible trip never faded. Even Julia, ever the Pollyanna, remarked frankly afterward, "There are no pleasant memories of that visit." Jesse Grant, now 60, hoped to withdraw from supervision of his leather business and pass daily control to his 3 sons. Ulysses responded readily to his suggestion that he join Simpson in running the store in Galena, Illinois. Then Jesse added an absolutely outrageous condition that floored his son and daughter-in-law. He wanted Julia and the 2 boys to stay with him and Hannah in Covington to benefit from the local schools. Both Grant parents viewed Julia as a spendthrift and wished to rein in her expenses. If Julia did not like that idea, they suggested she go back and live with the Dents in Missouri while her husband toiled in Galena. It was a proposal of breathtaking cruelty, all the more so because Ulysses had so long awaited reunion with his family. As Julia wrote, Captain Grant positively and indignantly refused his father's offer. One can only wonder whether his son's drinking problem made Jesse Grant issue such a heartless proposition. One further wonders whether Jesse was openly mocking Colonel Dent, who had long suggested that Julia and the children live with him while Ulysses languished at faraway military posts. The contretemps with his father left Grant with the unappealing alternative of relying on the largesse of his father-in-law. Colonel Dent had given Julia 60 acres of Whitehaven land as a wedding gift, but with a catch. He did not transfer legal title to her. Colonel Dent did this out of regard for his favorite daughter, said Louisa Boggs. He had a very poor opinion of his son-in-law. Grant decided to try his hand at farming this land. He lacked money to stock his farm, and Jesse later boasted he had supplied the funds for tools, seed, and horses. To take land from his father-in-law was a terrible come-down for Grant, who had to swallow the colonel's barely concealed scorn. Grant's friend, George W. Fishback, a St. Louis journalist, sympathized with his plight. It must have been a terrible mortification to Grant to be set apart on that little tract of farmland given to his wife by her father. Colonel Dent contributed little or nothing to support Grant and preferred to comment with ridicule and bitterness upon his unpromising son-in-law. At first, Ulysses and Julia Grant shared the main house at Whitehaven, but by spring 1855, an opportune moment arose to flee Colonel Dent's baleful eye. Julia's brother, Louis, who remained in California, allowed them to use his house, Wishton Wish, an Indian term meaning whippoorwill, that stood shaded by majestic oaks about a mile from the colonel's quarters. This large, rambling house, which Julia lauded as a beautiful English villa, had front and back porches, pitched roofs, and dormer windows, and was commodious enough to absorb the latest addition to Grant's family, a little girl named Ellen, in honor of Julia's mother, who was born on July 4th and was always known as Nellie. Rolling up his sleeves, Grant cleared the 60 acres for farming, pulling up tree stumps and planting corn and grinding wheat at the nearby grist mill of Henry Clay Wright. Grant was a small, thin man then, with a close-cropped brown beard, recalled Wright. He had no overcoat, I remember, and he wore tall boots, quite unlike any others in the neighborhood. He had a way of keeping people at arm's length. Eager to prove his worth, Grant soon added oats, Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, melons, beets, cucumbers, and cabbages, working with a resolve that won plaudits even from his skeptical father. During all this time, he worked like a slave, admitted Jesse Grant. No man ever worked harder. In this grueling labor, Grant was industrious and resourceful, selling timber props for tunnels of nearby coal mines. In the winter, donning dingy old army overalls, he loaded wagons to sell cords of wood on St. Louis street corners. Surely another blow to his pride. Invariably, he strolled beside the loaded wagons rather than ride, even though this entailed a 10-mile hike. The horses, he quipped, have enough to draw without carrying a lazy rider. Dr. William Taussig, mayor of Carondelet, remembered how Grant lingered on a log before a blacksmith's shop. A serious, dignified-looking man with slouched hat, high boots, and trousers tucked in, smoking a clay pipe and waiting for his horses to be shod. Taussig perceived that Grant's seemingly indolent and apathetic manner fooled people into overlooking his true powers hidden under the surface of this silent, phlegmatic man. Perhaps to show independence, Grant decided to craft a house with his bare hands. Julia was reluctant to leave Wishton Wish, which suited me in every way, but she recognized her husband's preference for a place closer to the land he farmed. At Colonel Dent's urging, Grant constructed a warm log house that required felling trees, stripping bark, shaping logs, carting cellar stones, and splitting shingles. "I worked very hard, never losing a day because of bad weather, and accomplished the object in a moderate way," Grant wrote. In its final phase, the building evolved into a communal project, finished with neighborly goodwill. When the logs were ready to be installed, Grant set out invitations for a raising, and enthusiastic friends demonstrated the respect Grant had earned in the community. One man stood at each corner as they lifted logs into place in 2 days, with Grant completing the roof and interior by himself. From the outside, the house seemed rough and crude, with uneven timbers and an eccentric wood pattern emblazoned across the front. It was a handmade house, hewn by a willing amateur. This rustic dwelling, with 2 stories, had a hall running down the middle, flanked by stone chimneys on either side. Showing his puckish humor, or perhaps mocking the fancy names of Whitehaven and Wish-ton-Wish, Grant anointed his log cabin Hardscrabble, a name reflecting his troubles. Whatever pride he took in this residence, it violated Julia's sense of gentility. "It was so crude and so homely that I did not like it at all, but I did not say so," said Julia. "I got out all my pretty covers, baskets, books, etc., and tried to make it look homelike and comfortable, but this was hard to do." When she nearly yielded to depression, Julia decided instead to will herself to be happy. Even during this trying period, Grant displayed a steady temper. Once his arduous days in the field ended, he retreated with gratitude to Hardscrabble. After long years confined on army posts, he prized his domesticity, and his simple home became a haven where he was completely relaxed and happy. When Grant later became famous and reporters portrayed this as a difficult time, Julia scoffed at such negative talk, sprinkling stardust over the period. "We always had enough for us and our little children," she insisted. "We were always happy, even when circumstances around us weren't going as planned." She had little patience with those who recollected her husband as dejected, low-spirited, badly dressed, and even slovenly. "They did not know my Captain Grant, for he was always perfection, both in manner and person, a cheerful, self-reliant gentleman." Partly Julia's sanguine view arose from joy that her family had finally come together, a novelty that trumped any hardship. She often pointed out that this was the first place she and Ulysses ever called home. But there was also a make-believe side to Julia Grant, who had a penchant for romanticizing whatever suffering she and her husband had endured. Her devout creed was never to admit failure and to gaze unashamedly on the bright side of things. Her incurable optimism proved correct when it came to the special destiny reserved for her husband. Although he never thirsted for fame, Julia, tugged by restless ambition for him, spied greatness lurking in his future. Dent slave Mary Robinson recalled Julia sitting on a rocking chair and speaking to relatives about her financial distress. "But we will not always be in this condition," she announced, disclosing that the previous night she had dreamed Ulysses was elected president. The rest all laughed and looked upon it as a capital joke. Although Julia's sisters teased her about these exalted prophecies, she never surrendered faith in her husband's worth, and, beset by repeated failure, he needed that unwavering affirmation. Everyone who knew the Grants commented on the power Julia exercised over her husband. Julia doted on Ulysses, who beamed as he soaked in her bottomless adoration. She fussed over his unkempt hair, whiskers, and clothing. "Your father is perfection," she instructed her children. "I just want to make sure others see this too." For Julia, he was simply a superman, capable of wondrous feats. She remembered how he lifted a 200-pound beam, how he could draw almost anything, how he made paper boats for the children, how he rode 50 miles in a day without breaking a sweat. Even as president, she maintained, he could perform 25 or 30 chin-ups without exertion, and he always shared her pride in his strength. The Grants delighted in holding hands and kept their love affair fresh. He was the tenderest and sweetest of husbands, Julia declared. When Ulysses teased her, she interpreted this dry mirth as shot through with deep love. She was fond of dresses with enormous bows tied in back, and Ulysses liked to slip behind her and unravel the knot. "Ulysses," she would cry in mock anger, "you must leave my bows alone." The couple seldom quarreled, but when they did, Grant withdrew in silence. When he returned, they immediately made up and embraced. Nothing bothered Julia more than insinuations that her husband was an illiterate yahoo. To save her eyes, he read aloud to her for hours each evening, and they plowed through hundreds of books. Mary Robinson confirmed that Grant was unusually bookish. Most of his leisure time he spent in reading. He was one of the greatest readers I ever saw. Grant retained special affection for Dickens, especially the Pickwick Papers, Dombey and Son, Little Dorrit, and Oliver Twist. "He rarely laughed aloud," said his son Fred, "but his eyes would twinkle over a good bit of wit, and occasionally, when very much pleased, he would utter a gentle laugh which held the essence of mirth." While the Grants faulted Julia as a free-spending Southern woman, it was Ulysses who had trouble managing money, and Julia who took charge of family finances. By now it was clear that Grant was an easy victim for spongers, even when he could scarcely spare the money. As Hannah Grant observed, Ulysses would cheerfully give his last garment to a needy friend. Whenever Julia wanted some bauble or piece of jewelry, he would buy it for her, whether they could afford it or not. The children found money safer in their mother's hands. Ulysses and Julia Grant were loving parents, incorporating their children into social activities. Whether attending a dance, a quilting bee, or church, they showed up with at least one child propped on each saddle. Grant had two congenital weaknesses, children and horses, and was gentle with both. "I have never known a man who had such nice ways about him in that respect as my father," said Fred. Grant could be jovially indulgent, glorying in the mischievous antics of his boys, whom he dubbed little rascals or little dogs. He derived special pleasure from roughhousing with them, getting down on all fours to wrestle. Entering into their world, he kneaded pellets of bread and flung them at his children during meals. He playfully encouraged Nellie, born on July 4th, to imagine the annual fireworks were staged in her honor. He tried to instill courage in his children, putting them on horses and urging them to swim at early ages, and he thought it important that they hold their own with neighborhood ruffians. "It teaches a boy how to take care of himself." The household showed all the open affection that had been absent in Grant's own boyhood home. With none of the disciplinarian in his nature, Grant tolerated the rowdy behavior of his sons, sometimes to the dismay of straight-laced friends. He gave his children moral instruction. "Lying is the foundation of all crimes and follies," was a favorite maxim, but never resorted to corporal punishment or raised his voice. When the children got out of hand, it fell to Julia to restore order, and she could be quite definite in her views. "If the children balked," Ulysses told them, "you must not quarrel with Mama. She knows what is best for you, and you must always obey her." The children were sensitive enough to their father's moods that a sharp look sufficed to correct unruly behavior. Grant rarely showed anger, preferring to bury his hurts. "He ignored most slights," said Buck, "even if he felt them keenly." At first glance, it seems remarkable that the drinking issue did not detract from the Grants' happy marriage, but he seldom drank with his family around. During all the time I knew Grant, between his return from California in 1854 to the fall of Vicksburg, I never saw him intoxicated, wrote Emma Dent. Whatever the grinding misery of these Missouri years, they were mostly a triumph for Grant's sobriety, which surely owed much to Julia's steadfast, loving concern. Anchored in the bosom of his family, free from loneliness, Grant was able to conquer his craving for drink. During these years, Grant shrank from the booze-soaked society of Army friends. He often ran into fellow officers from Jefferson Barracks, who discovered the new Grant practiced abstinence. Don Carlos Buell, then a captain, averred that Grant drank nothing but water, and Major Joseph J. Reynolds agreed. He will go into the bar with you, but he will not touch anything. When one old West Point classmate invited Grant to the Planter's House Hotel bar, Grant avowed his new sobriety. I will go and look at you, but I never drink anything myself. The one dissenting voice from this portrait of Grant's abstinence was Jesse A. Jones, who years later recounted that his relative, Edward Gray, a civil engineer, often said he had carried Grant home on his back, drunk, from St. Louis, Missouri, to Grant's home on his farm. Such reports of Grant imbibing in St. Louis are conspicuous by their absence, however, and he appeased his always powerful oral cravings by smoking pipes and cigars. In those days, I often heard doctors tell him his incessant smoking would kill him, said Mary Robinson. At that time, he chewed tobacco excessively also. Though sober, Grant projected a defeated air on the St. Louis streets, a man with the life beaten out of him. His injured pride cast a deep gloom over him. The depression visible in his expressionless face, seamy clothes, and absence of mirth were discernible to those around him. His need to sell firewood on the streets, huddled in a faded blue army coat, broadcast his decline to the world. "Great God, Grant, what are you doing?" exclaimed an officer who had last seen him in Mexico. "I am solving the problem of poverty," Grant explained. His reliance on Colonel Dent's charity must have grated. When one officer encountered Grant striding outside the Planter's House, he inquired what he was now doing, and Grant retorted that he was farming on a piece of land belonging to Mrs. Grant, some 10 miles out in the country. Grant was dignified in his downcast state, exhibiting a rigid sense of honor and virtue. James Longstreet was playing cards at the Planter's House when Grant walked in, and he was shocked to see how far down the social ladder his old friend had tumbled. Grant was poorly dressed and really in needy circumstances. The next day, Grant accosted him and pressed a $5 gold piece into his palm to repay a debt now 15 years old. "You must take it," Grant said, even after Longstreet refused. "I cannot live with anything in my possession that is not mine." To allow Grant to save face, Longstreet reluctantly accepted the money. The two men would next meet at Appomattox Courthouse, when Longstreet was Robert E. Lee's chief commander. A sad letter in Grant's papers suggests that even his father kept a wary distance from him. Right after Christmas 1856, Grant was shocked to see inscribed in the register of the Planter's House, J.R. Grant, Kentucky. He checked with the hotel clerk that it was indeed his father's signature. "I made sure it was you and that I should find you when I got home," Grant wrote to his father. "Was it you?" We don't know what Jesse Grant replied or why he might have been dodging his eldest son in this manner. On January 14, 1857, Julia's mother, Ellen Renshaw Dent, died, and a lonesome Colonel Dent asked his daughter and son-in-law to move back into the main house with him. This delighted Julia, who had detested the cramped simplicity of hardscrabble, but it must have mortified her husband, who had just told his father he hoped to support himself on his farm income before too long, and begged him for a $500 loan at a steep 10% interest rate. "Ulysses," Jesse supposedly said, "when you are ready to come north, I will give you a start, but so long as you make your home among a tribe of slaveholders, I will do nothing." Luckily for Grant, within a year, Colonel Dent rented Whitehaven to him and moved into St. Louis, leaving his son-in-law with 200 acres of plowed farmland and 250 woodland acres. One Sunday afternoon, shortly before Ellen Dent's demise, Colonel Dent and Captain Grant sat smoking on the porch, differing over the hotly debated question of admitting new slave states to the Union. Pro-slavery sentiment was widespread in St. Louis, with auctions still conducted on the courthouse steps and slave plantations dotting the countryside. Ellen Dent was impressed by how thoughtfully her son-in-law dissected the situation. Afterward, she told her daughters, "Remember what I say, that little man will fill the highest place in this government. His light is now hid under a bushel, but circumstances will occur, and at no distant day, when his worth and wisdom will be shown and appreciated." In time, Grant emerged as a staunch critic of slavery. As he stated in his memoirs, "Southern slave owners believed that the ownership of slaves conferred a sort of patent of nobility. They convinced themselves first of the divine origin of the institution, and next, that that particular institution was not safe in the hands of any body of legislators but themselves." At this period, however, Grant, like many northern whites, felt more ambivalent, opposing slavery in theory, yet also fearing that outright abolitionism might lead to bloody sectional conflict. Julia still clung to a paternalistic attitude toward slavery, associating it fondly with her girlhood and the Southern traditions represented by her father. In November 1856, Grant cast his first vote in a presidential election. After selling a load of firewood, he was galloping by a St. Louis polling station when he decided to stop, lash his horse to a tree, and vote. The Whig Party had collapsed after the brouhaha over the Kansas-Nebraska Act, leading to the rise of the anti-slavery Republicans, who nominated John C. Fremont as their first presidential candidate, while the nativist American Party, the Know-Nothings, opted for ex-president Millard Fillmore. To his later embarrassment, Grant voted for Democrat James Buchanan of Pennsylvania, a seasoned diplomat and former Secretary of State who hoped to avert civil war by appeasing the South. Grant knew little about Buchanan, but a good deal about Fremont, the famous pathfinder who had explored the Far West and whom Grant deplored as a shameless self-promoter. "The reason I voted for Buchanan was that I knew Fremont. That was the only vote I ever cast. If I had ever had any political sympathies, they would have been with the Whigs. I was raised in that school." In future years, Grant liked to joke that his first attempt in politics had been a great failure. Even though Abraham Lincoln delivered more than 100 speeches for the Republican ticket, Buchanan carried Illinois and the election. It seems unlikely that Grant, having grown up in a household saturated with abolitionist politics, was as ignorant about Buchanan's views as he claimed. As everybody observed, he was an assiduous newspaper reader. While Grant lived quietly on his farm from 1854 to 1858, noted a friend, no man was better informed than he on every phase of the controversy. In his memoirs, Grant dropped any pretense that he had solely voted against Fremont and not for Buchanan. "It was evident to my mind that the election of a Republican president in 1856 meant the secession of all the slave states and rebellion." Southern fervor, already tinged with violence, threatened the tenuous balance between North and South. In May 1856, Congressman Preston Brooks of South Carolina thrashed and nearly killed Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts after the latter made a scalding anti-slavery speech, "The Crime Against Kansas." many incendiary political events unfolded not far from where Grant lived. A few days after the Sumner beating, in Bleeding, Kansas, John Brown and his sons brutally executed 5 men who endorsed slavery. Abolitionist settlers there, known as Free Soilers, had to fend off incursions from pro-slavery forces from Missouri who employed bullets and fraudulent ballots to secure their goals. In the end, 2 separate legislatures vied for power in the state. Then, in March 1857, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney handed down the infamous Dred Scott decision. Scott was a Missouri slave taken to the free state of Illinois and the free Wisconsin territory, who then sued for freedom on this basis after his master died. The court denied Scott's right to sue on the grounds that he was a Negro, an inferior being, and therefore not a citizen. To worsen matters, Taney said Congress lacked power to ban slavery from the territories, annulling the Missouri Compromise. Taney's verdict made the whole country complicit in the horror of slavery. Bemoaning the decision, the New York editor William Cullen Bryant wrote, "Wherever our flag floats, it is the flag of slavery," a comment that typified Northern outrage. Although we have no contemporary observations by Grant on the case, he enjoyed a direct connection to it. After the decision, Dred Scott and his wife were purchased by Taylor Blow, who supported Scott's lawsuit and then freed the couple. Blow, a close friend of Grant's, would recommend him for a county job 2 years later. Through marriage into the Dent family, Grant was thrust into a vexing situation vis-à-vis the passionate slavery controversy. Colonel Dent had given Julia the use of 4 slaves, Dan, Julia, John, and Eliza, all teenagers. "They were born at the old farm and were excellent," wrote Julia, "though so young." Colonel Dent never transferred to Julia legal title to these slaves, for the simple reason that under Missouri law, his hated son-in-law would become their owner. Having grown up in an ardent abolitionist household, Grant made it known, according to Mary Robinson, that he wanted to give his wife's slaves their freedom as soon as possible. Emma Dent, who thought Grant still conflicted about slavery, commented tartly, "I do not think that Grant was such a rank abolitionist that Julia's slaves had to be forced upon him." At the same time, she conceded Grant's opposition to human slavery as an institution. Most people sensed that Grant opposed slavery, and when a neighbor doubted the loyalty of a Dent slave, Grant shot back, "I don't know why a black skin may not cover a true heart as well as a white one." Henry Clay Wright, who milled Grant's grain, detected his dissatisfaction with slavery. "We were all slaveholding farmers in that day, and Grant's wife had a couple of slaves, and yet we felt that he was not exactly one of us." Legend claims that Grant halted the whipping of a slave by a local farmer. Since Julia's 4 slaves were young, they remained house servants. For field work, Grant hired 2 black men and employed a Dent slave named William Jones to help raise corn, potatoes, oats, wheat, and clover. He exhibited no false pride in working alongside these men, something that would have been beneath the dignity of his purse-proud father-in-law. It was not in Grant's nature to coerce people, and his just treatment of black men said much about his egalitarian feelings. As Julia's cousin recalled, "He was no hand to manage Negroes. He couldn't force them to do anything." Mrs. Grant would say, "Aren't you going to whip Jewel for doing that?" And he would only smile and say, "No, I guess not." One slave, Uncle Jason, confirmed that Grant was the kindest man he ever worked for. Grant hired free black workers and paid them a decent wage, which bothered slave-owning neighbors. Every time Ulysses S. Grant appeared to touch rock bottom, his fortunes sank even further. Despite his initial lack of knowledge about farming, he had gamely tried to succeed, until his hands grew coarse, he visibly aged, and he developed a permanent stoop. The work was done principally with his own hands, notwithstanding the fact that many of his neighbors owned slaves and considered manual labor beneath a gentleman, observed an acquaintance. As early as February 1857, Grant warned his father that it was pointless to persist in farming without a fresh cash infusion. To survive, he continued to hawk firewood on the St. Louis streets, and the time thus spent destroyed any chance of prospering as a farmer. I regard every load of wood taken when the services of both myself and team are required on the farm as a direct loss of more than the value of the load. By that summer, he bewailed that his wheat crop yielded only 75 bushels instead of the 400 or 500 he had projected, although he still bravely held out hope for his potato, sweet potato, melon, and cabbage crops. Then the 1857 economic depression provoked widespread bank failures, massive unemployment, and precipitous declines in commodity prices, dashing any chance of an economic rebound for Grant. As his life steadily unraveled, he pawned his gold watch and chain for $20 on December 23, 1857, to purchase Christmas presents for his children, perhaps the symbolic nadir of his life. Then on February 6th, he and Julia had a fourth mouth to feed with the birth of a third son named Jesse after his grandfather. That Grant named a son after his fallible father shows how he still loomed very large in his life. Perhaps in response to stress, Grant developed crippling headaches as frequently as once a month. "Oh, do not ask me to speak," he would moan to Julia. "I have a dreadful headache." Julia would seat him in an armchair, dim the lights, then bathe his feet in mustard solution. Ever since childhood, Grant had been afflicted with fever and ague, whose signs were severe chills and sweats. In 1858, this malady recurred along with malaria, likely contracted while crossing Panama or Nicaragua, and with similar symptoms. In Galena, his brother Simpson was slowly wasting away from tuberculosis, and Grant must have feared he was drifting in that direction. His various illnesses hung on for months. Even as a cold spring played havoc with his crops, and he curtailed drastically the time devoted to farming. Julia and the slaves also fell sick until Whitehaven resembled a small hospital ward. Most upsetting was that Fred came down with typhoid fever, and Grant worried he might not survive. Although Fred pulled through, the time had come for him and Buck to get proper schooling, which would further hamper the straitened family finances. Until this point, Grant had schooled the two older boys at home, teaching them arithmetic, reading, and spelling. With his son cast into this abject state, Jesse Grant showed up and made a vigorous pitch for him to move his family to Covington, Kentucky, and join his business. Where he once boasted of his son's prowess, he now openly disparaged him. When an old Georgetown neighbor ran into him, Jesse said, "He would have to take U.S. and his family home and make him over again, as he had no business qualifications, whatever, had failed in everything. All his other boys were good businessmen." With extreme reluctance, Ulysses agreed to wind up the farm and relocate to Kentucky, a plan scotched when his sisters protested. Julia had bitterly opposed the plan and celebrated its demise. "I was joyous at the thought of not going to Kentucky, for the captain's family, with the exception of his mother, did not like me. They considered me unpardonably extravagant, and I considered them inexcusably the other way, and may unintentionally have shown my feelings." According to Julia Boggs, even Hannah Grant had quietly soured on her daughter-in-law. Old Mrs. Grant was a woman who did her own housework, and she couldn't think well of a daughter-in-law who employed slaves, though she said very little about it. Notwithstanding his medical and monetary travails, Grant watched with mounting dread the political turmoil convulsing the country. From August 21st through October 15th, Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas, rivals for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, squared off in a series of debates that focused on slavery, and Grant followed the newspaper coverage. Like Grant, Lincoln was plain in dress and traveled from one debate to the next on ordinary passenger trains. Grant admitted he was by no means a Lincoln man in that contest, but I recognized then his great ability. He thought it a nice question to say who got the best of the argument in the debates. Even though Lincoln lost the election, the debates elevated him to a figure of national stature, while Republicans scored stunning triumphs in New York, Pennsylvania, and Indiana that fall. After four frustrating years, by autumn 1858, Grant's farming ambitions had foundered forever, and he auctioned off his stock, crops, and farming equipment. This capped a four-year period of failure so excruciating that Grant skipped over it altogether in his memoirs. He now paced the St. Louis streets, searching for work, obscure and invisible to the many people he passed, a bleak, defeated little man with a mysterious aura of solitude. "He walked about like any citizen," said one woman, "but people made way for him, and he walked through the crowd as though solitary." Grant could never escape the shadow of his father and father-in-law, and it was now Colonel Dent who turned to his relative, Harry Boggs, for help. In early 1859, Boggs agreed to join Grant in a real estate partnership titled Boggs and Grant, in which Grant would serve as a glorified clerk. Grant still knew many Army officers at Jefferson Barracks, and Colonel Dent thought that despite his son-in-law's abysmal ignorance of real estate, he might woo them as clients. While eager for her husband to find work, Julia suspected he lacked professional aggression and would overly sympathize with debtors. "I cannot imagine how my dear husband ever thought of going into such a business, as he never could collect a penny that was owed to him." Boggs and Grant operated from the Pine Street law offices of McClellan, Hillier, and Moody, its stated mission to buy and sell real estate, collect rents, and negotiate loans. At the outset, Grant was hopeful about the firm, but when a dozen similar real estate partnerships sprang up downtown, the glut doomed its prospects. Julia was prescient that her husband was not cut out for collecting rent. If he dunned an old Army comrade, he ended up lighting a cigar and whiling away the afternoon with reminiscences. Grant also lacked administrative skills and kept untidy records. "Mr. Boggs went east on business, leaving the captain in charge, and when he returned, he found everything upside down," recalled Louisa Boggs. "The books were in confusion, the wrong people had been let into houses, and the owners were much concerned." Still debilitated by fever and ague, Grant sometimes had to be helped to the streetcar by one of the McClellan, Hillier, and Moody lawyers. Grant was so broke he could not afford to stay in a hotel or boarding house, much less bring his wife and four children to St. Louis. Harry and Louisa Boggs offered him a bare room in their house on South 15th Street, where he turned into a melancholy presence. His austere room had only a bed, a bowl, and a pitcher, set on an adjoining chair. Since this wretched back room was unheated, he sat with his hosts in the evening, warming himself by their living room fire. "He would smile at times, but I never heard him laugh aloud," said Louisa Boggs. "He was a sad man. He seemed almost in despair." Grant seemed to be staring into an abyss. "I don't think he saw a light ahead, not a particle. I don't think he had any ambition further than to educate and take care of his family." Every Saturday, Grant trudged 12 miles to Whitehaven, spent an evening with his family, then retraced his steps on Sunday. The Boggses, well aware of Grant's drinking history, stayed vigilant about the problem. "It was his one weakness," said Louisa Boggs. His worst temptation was in meeting some old army friend. Luckily, Harry Boggs was a strict temperance man, and Grant never drank around him. As secession gathered strength, Grant discovered a deep-seated patriotism that he may not have known existed before. St. Louis had many residents with Southern sympathies, and it was dangerous to declare pro-Union sentiments too openly. It seemed as if the irrepressible conflict of which Senator William Seward warned would soon arrive. Profane and blustering, Harry Boggs liked to rant about black Republicans, and Grant must have found this talk insufferable. "He was Northern," said Louisa Boggs, "while Mr. Boggs and I were both Southern in sentiment." As he monitored current affairs, Grant was upset by what he read in the press and enjoyed talking with William S. Hillyer, a young Republican lawyer from Kentucky with whom he shared office space. His friend John W. Emerson remembered Grant at the office, sitting alone at his desk with his hand holding a newspaper hanging listlessly by his side, with every evidence of deep thought suggesting sadness. Grant underwent a slow dawning political awakening. "When I was in St. Louis the year before Lincoln's election, it made my blood run cold to hear friends of mine, Southern men, as many of my friends were, deliberately discuss the dissolution of the Union as though it were a tariff bill. I could not endure it." Grant's views, simple but clear, were fiercely held. Grant never said anything to indicate that he saw war coming or might play a prominent part. On the other hand, the attorneys he worked with discerned the evident zest with which he analyzed battles then raging in Italy. He would study newspaper maps and exclaim, "This movement was a mistake. If I commanded the army, I would do thus and so." The attorneys listened with suppressed smirks, as if Grant's words betrayed a pathetic streak of self-delusion in this thwarted man. By early March, Grant brought his family to a house on 7th and Lynch Streets that proved too expensive. He then swapped hardscrabble for a snug, plain, two-story house at 9th and Barton Streets on the edge of town. Since hardscrabble was worth more than the St. Louis townhouse, Grant received a $3,000 note but was swindled yet again and had to initiate a lawsuit that dragged on for years. His new house was quite modest, with a porch on one side and a low upper story, but he was at least reunited with his family. Fred and Buck began to attend school regularly, and family life, if threadbare, regained some semblance of normality. Grant delighted in the idiosyncrasies of his four children, treating the sturdy Fred like a young man, exercising care with the smart but delicate Buck, being tender with his beloved Nellie, and rejoicing in the antics of mischievous Jesse. By this point, the Grants could no longer mask the depressed state of their finances. One day, a business friend of Grant's suggested to his wife that she drop by and pay a courtesy call on Julia. The woman did so and returned to her husband in high dudgeon. "Why did you send me there? The house is shabbily furnished, and they must be very poor." For Julia, who grew up in pampered comfort, the fall in status contradicted her favored self-image. On one occasion, a lady friend asked Julia to accompany her on a shopping trip downtown. "I can't do it," Julia protested. "I have no shoes fit to wear on the street." Through it all, Julia maintained her custom of keeping slaves and had two slaves help with the children. In March 1859, she was scheduled to take the family to visit Jesse and Hannah Grant in Kentucky and wanted to take along one slave to care for the children. Upon reflection, she worried what would happen as she passed through Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. While the Dred Scott decision had endorsed a master's right to take slaves into free states, Julia was afraid that in passing through free states, she might have some trouble, Grant explained to his father, inciting the reason for Julia canceling her trip. That Grant was progressively more troubled by the immorality of slavery became patently clear that spring. He had acquired from Colonel Dent the mulatto slave named William Jones, who had worked on Dent's farm and was now 35 years old. It was the only time Grant ever owned a slave, and Jones may have come as a gift. Then, on March 29, 1859, Grant appeared at Circuit Court in St. Louis to file papers that declared, "I do hereby manumit, emancipate, and set free said William from slavery forever." Still struggling financially, Grant could have earned a considerable sum had he chosen to sell Jones rather than liberate him. Instead, he made good on his pledge to set free Dent slaves when it came within his power. In the inflamed political atmosphere in St. Louis, this bold step planted Grant firmly on the side of those critical of the South's peculiar institution. By summer 1859, the partnership of Boggs and Grant teetered in a rocky condition. Grant did not have the stomach for collecting rents and hated how Boggs violated the privacy of clients and retailed gossip behind their backs. Worse still, the flagging business could scarcely support one partner, but definitely not two. Louisa Boggs, a schoolteacher, pressed her husband to wind up the business and go into something more lucrative, and the Boggs and Grant partnership was formally dissolved. Once again, the job outlook for Grant appeared ominous, and he applied for a position as county engineer. He would superintend local roads and receive a $1,500 annual salary. He submitted to the 5-member board of county commissioners an impressive array of 35 supporting letters, including one from Taylor Blow, who had backed Dred Scott. Joseph J. Reynolds, who knew Grant at West Point, wrote that he had always maintained a high standing and graduated with great credit, especially in mathematics and engineering. Throughout his life, Grant shrank from applying pressure to obtain positions, and now conducted himself in gentlemanly fashion, refusing to lobby the commissioners. Both he and Julia were still superstitious, so he consulted a French fortune teller who forecast his defeat. "I will come within an ace of being elected, but I will be beaten," he reported to Julia. "In a short time we will leave the city and I will engage for a time in a mercantile business. Something will happen very soon, and then I will begin to rise in the world." The selection process for county engineer turned out to be highly politicized, and Grant fell on the wrong side of the political divide. Three of the 5 commissioners were Free Soil Republicans, the remaining 2 Democrats, and Grant was voted down because of his association with Colonel Dent. As a Republican member, Dr. William Taussig admitted, "The Dents, at least the old gentlemen, were known to be pro-slavery Democrats and outspoken rebels." Grant lived with them, and though nothing was known of his political views, the shadow of their disloyalty necessarily fell on him. With a potential war looming, the commissioners stressed Union loyalty, and Grant understood the bias against him. "You may judge from the result of the action of the county commissioners that I am strongly identified with the Democratic Party," he wrote to his father. Aside from voting for Buchanan, he had adhered mostly to Whig tradition and had approached candidates pragmatically. The sensitive Grant reeled from his defeat for county engineer and later referred to the agony this caused him. Julia long remembered with some bitterness her husband's defeat by that most unjust majority. Grant knew the winner was a German immigrant at a time when St. Louis had a large German population. "My opponent had the advantage of birth over me," he was a citizen by adoption, "and carried off the prize," Grant wrote. In breaking the news to Julia, he grumbled, "The Germans are loyal to each other." To another local resident, he protested that no American can get anything in this town, and complained that almost all county jobs were held by immigrants. In this woeful mood, Grant flirted briefly with the Know-Nothing Party, which inveighed against immigration and the Catholic Church. As foreign laborers flocked to build railroads, native-born Protestant workers resisted their competition and banded together in the mysterious Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. To safeguard their secrecy, they were instructed to reply to outside questions, "I know nothing." Grant's attraction to this movement was short-lived. There was a lodge near my new home, and I was invited to join it. I accepted the invitation, was initiated, attended a meeting just 1 week later, and never went to another afterwards. In time, Grant renounced such secret societies and any groups that opposed freedom of worship. He also came to view his loss of the county engineer job as a blessing, for had he gotten it, he would have been ensconced in a comfortable position at the outbreak of the Civil War and might never have joined the military. While Grant recuperated from his disappointment, John Brown and a group of abolitionist zealots raided the Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, hoping to seize weapons and foment a slave rebellion in the South. After barricading themselves inside the fire engine house, they were surrounded and seized by a Marine contingent led by Robert E. Lee. The unrepentant Brown, charged with murder and treason, was marched off to the gallows, but he left behind an apocalyptic prophecy that the crimes of this guilty land would never be purged away, except with blood. For the South, Brown's raid gave flesh to their worst nightmares and deepened the widening gulf with the North, where many embraced him as a martyr. Grant had grown up hearing stories about Brown from Jesse Grant. Nevertheless, he denounced categorically the abortive raid on Harper's Ferry. It was certainly the act of an insane man to attempt the invasion of the South and the overthrow of slavery with less than 20 men. As a consolation prize for losing the county engineer position, Grant got a job as a clerk in the custom house, but when the collector died within a month and was replaced by a new person, he prowled the streets again, searching for work. Those who now encountered him never forgot his hopeless, downcast air. He greeted me kindly, but seemed to be in a very distressed and disconsolate condition, said George W. Fishback. I had never before seen him so much depressed. He was shabbily dressed, his beard unshaven, his face anxious, and the whole exterior of the man denoting a profound discouragement at the result of his experiment to maintain himself in St. Louis. Grant flailed about for a job and devised a quixotic plan to launch a hardware business in Colorado, a far-fetched idea that Jesse Grant refused to finance. As the impecunious Grant soldiered on, it became clear that only his father could provide an escape route from his misery. When Julia suggested that he go to see Jesse, he adamantly resisted. Julia then reminded him that his father had always been not only willing but anxious to serve him, in his own way, to be sure. After a little hesitation at leaving me with the children and servants, he decided to start the next day. Grant must have known his father would try to lure him back north, a position now more appealing than it had been 2 years earlier. As Fishback surmised, Grant no doubt foresaw the threatened Civil War and felt that as an old defender of the flag, he had better take his chances among his people in the northern states. Within a week, Julia claimed, her husband began sending her from Kentucky long and cheerful letters. But the documentary record suggests a far more pessimistic picture. As soon as he reached Covington, Ulysses wrote her that he had arrived with a headache and feeling bad generally. My head is nearly bursting with pain. Simpson Grant, then staying with Jesse and Hannah, was waging a losing struggle against tuberculosis, which forced him to keep going south in search of a cure. Although growing deaf in one ear and suffering from failing eyesight, Jesse Grant remained robust at 66, serving as Covington's postmaster. Having prospered as a merchant, Jesse was now worth $100,000, equivalent to nearly $3 million today, and employed about 50 people. When he reached 60 in 1854, he had begun to withdraw from active management of his business interests. His holdings included several tanneries near Portsmouth, Ohio, and leather goods stores in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Galena, Illinois. Ulysses came to Covington at a fortuitous juncture. The ailing Simpson had managed the Galena store and was more capable than his younger brother Orville, who assisted him. Simpson's health and the prospect that the erratic young Orville would end up running the Galena business must have alarmed Jesse Grant. When it came to a job for Ulysses, he deferred to Simpson, who agreed to send his older brother to the Galena store to stay until something else might turn up in his favor, and told him he must confine his wants within $800 a year, Jesse recalled. As it turned out, Ulysses left behind such a long trail of debts in St. Louis that he would draw out $1,500 the first year, money he returned to the store after he went into the Union Army. Always honorable about debts, Grant reassured creditors he would eventually repay every dollar. To be forced to serve as a clerk in his father's store at age 38, in a decidedly junior position to his two younger brothers, was a demeaning situation that Grant could only have regarded with rueful laughter. He had spent futile years trying to become a successful breadwinner, free of the twin tyrants who had lorded over him, his father and Colonel Dent. Now he had to shed his pride and capitulate to his father's will. As he told a friend in St. Louis, because he loved his family so much, he had decided that we'll all go to Galena and starve to death together. So, gathering up his family and modest belongings, he set off for Illinois, bearing a heavy load of blighted hopes.